Well, as the pandemic forced school shutdowns around the world, digital solutions entered center stage to support a sudden shift to remote learning, thrusting technology into the forefront. Remote and hybrid learning have quickly become the sole means of delivering education since last March, and almost 90% of students globally, or some 1.6 billion children, are now relying upon educational software or digital means for accessing their classes. Seemingly overnight, educational institutions were forced to digitize with varying degrees of success. While this pivot proved extremely challenging, it also presented educators with the opportunity to experiment with and introduce innovative educational technologies into the classroom. The edtech sector includes a slew of education-targeted solutions that can enhance remote learning as long as COVID-19 lasts, but also supplement analog curricula in a post-pandemic world. And while edtech holds great promise, I think students from lower-income households and across developing nations experience greater difficulties accessing remote classrooms due to a lack of sufficient internet access and device ownership, further exacerbating the digital divide. But for all school districts, the rise of edtech will continue to play an essential role in digitizing the classroom as well as enhancing it. And so the question begs, how has edtech been successfully implemented during the age of COVID-19, and what role will it play post the pandemic? Well, to upskill yourself on EdTech, let's welcome our panelists, Head of Process Ventures in India, Ashu Sharma, Wesley Lynch, the CEO and founder of Snaplify, and we've also got the founder and CEO of the Student Hub, Hertzi Kabaya, and Kerry Finn, CEO of independent advisory firm Alpha Wealth. Ashu, Prosus has been invested in the sector for roughly 5 years, and some of those investments appear to offer meaningful upside. Let's just talk broadly speaking about why the education and tech sectors coming together present such a beautiful opportunity. Why are they made for each other?
Thanks, Michael, for inviting me to the show. Look, I think what I'll say is specifically more relevant to the emerging economies. What's happening is that beyond the top 1% students in these economies, the quality of education that's accessible to the others really drops down pretty fast. Now you overlay on top of that the cultural affinity to education, and that's because education takes you to the next orbit in your life, and not just you, but your family. This dynamic opens a big gap between supply and demand to quality education. And how do you fill that gap? The only available way to fill that gap today is via internet and via technology. One classic example of a company in our portfolio is Byju. Byju caters to K-12 education in India. There's 250 million students in India. Beyond the top 1 million, others won't have access to good quality education. Byju opens up that gap, uses technology to bridge that gap between supply and demand, using tech both for content creation but also for content distribution. And this match, therefore, of education with technology, bridging this gap, makes it a unique combination which sort of addresses the most basic of human needs, especially and more so in emerging economies.
And Byju is really an interesting one. I mean, some would have seen it as the major sponsor on the Indian cricket team's kit, but it really is a fantastic example of what can happen when you get first mover advantage in a large market like India. What's the model here for Byju?
Absolutely. So what Byju is trying to do is provide access to top teachers and top content and top teaching methods to the Indian masses. This is not possible in an offline setting. This is not possible in a one-to-one or one-to-many virtual setting. And therefore, what the company has developed is an adaptive learning platform that uses content on one side and then sort of bunch of adaptive learning techniques to find a education journey or learning journey for each kid that's custom to that specific kid. If Michael is weak in algebra, the platform will give you more problems in that specific topic, will give you more content in that specific topic. mimicking access to a good quality teacher in an offline setting. Some of this is available for free for students, but beyond a certain level, you need to pay to get access to all capabilities of the platform. And so that freemium model kind of is interesting because the free content gets access to the top of the funnel, and then Baiju is a company that tries to engage with the parent to convert the free users into paid users.
Because I mean that is the interesting element of this, because it has that freemium layer, but then you seek to monetize it further down. How did you manage to overcome some of the challenges here before we move on in terms of access? And you say 250 million students beyond the 1 million, access to good quality education is tough when it comes to things like infrastructure and some of those emerging market challenges that we're grappling with here in South Africa.
Absolutely. I think there's two basic needs that had to be there for Baiju to be successful. One is cheap data. The second one is cheap devices. Now, I think initially when Baiju started, we were not in that situation. But over time, especially with the launch of Jio, and Jio, by the way, is India's one of the India's largest data and communication services provider, the cost per GB of data came down drastically. And then sort of with the launch of a lot of, let's say, cheaper tablets, the other infrastructure issue around access to devices also got solved. Besides this, what Baiju did initially and continues to do is to provide an SD card-based solution. So when you buy the product, you have the option to access it online using data or access it through an SD card. And if you need to access, or you want to access over SD card, that will be shipped to your home, thereby taking care of any issues that you as a student may have because of bandwidth availability.
I think some lessons for us here in South Africa in that approach. Wesley, to bring you in here, Snaplify's piece of the education puzzle. What is the problem that you're seeking to solve with Snaplify?
So I think there's certainly a lot of challenges that are similar that's already been outlined in India. And I think we're definitely tackling much of those challenges, although I think perhaps in a more African context. But it's really about providing digital content, first and foremost, to the learners. I think also providing integration of technology that aids the teachers. A lot of what COVID has shown us is not necessarily, you know, out with the old and in with the new. It's about how do we provide a blended approach. So it's about providing technology to teachers to make them more effective. How do they perhaps manage this transition where ultimately they're trying to, I suppose, execute a teaching and learning practice that they would have done previously in the classroom, now online. So it's really about that mixture of digital content, tools to enable the teaching and learning, and then also creating a community of best practices that are unique to the African context as to how do we sew this all together to kind of provide a holistic approach for integration of technology into the classroom.
And a teacher-led approach, it resonates with me and I think many people. If you think back to your school days, what were those subjects that you tended to excel in or remember? They were generally led by one or two exceptional teachers that stick out in your memory even to this day. The teacher is so central to the pedagogy and to the solution. So how have you sought to assist the teachers as they transition into a world where they're doing all of this teaching and learning online?
I think our approach has really been about listening to the teachers. I think our DNA is very much, you know, we see ourselves as technology people that are moving into education, not education people that are now picking up technology. So first and foremost, we're listening very sincerely to the challenges that the teachers are having on the ground and providing these tools. So you know, different teachers in you know, schools that have different degrees of infrastructure and connectivity, or even how you would use technology in a primary school or high school, are very, very different. So the first thing is about listening, understanding what are the realities of the problems, like, you know, really getting into the trenches. And, you know, sometimes it's you know, these big sweeping solutions, but sometimes very, very simple things that can make a huge difference to teachers. But it really starts with one, listening, and then collecting data, you know, looking at what the analytics says, what's really being used and what's making an impact, and then driving those learnings back into the ecosystem and, you know, continually iterate to improve that experience for the teachers and, you know, by proxy also obviously the learners.
And as the EdTech theme continues and that data volume, that data lake grows and swells, so I'm sure we expected to see an exponential improvement based on the data that you're getting in the solutions that you are driving. Hertzie, to bring you in, NASPAS Foundry, I think towards the end of last year, invested around 45 million rand in Student Hub. What is your piece of the education puzzle?
At a Student Hub, we focus on post-school education. So it's really not at high school level. It's really like after high school. That's where we really focus. And the focus at the Student Hub, what we do is basically building tools for various stakeholders to contact with each other. I'll explain. So basically what we do, we look at post-school education as a whole and say, and look at all the stakeholders that have to transact with each other in order to deliver quality education to students. So you're looking at the teachers, the HODs, you're looking at employers, and all the various stakeholders that need to provide services to ensure that students get a great education. So what we've built now is a platform that actually gives them the tools to transact with each other. So we've got a student-facing side where you've got the teachers, lectures in this case, engaging with students and providing study support and all. And it's really collected data on student behaviors and all that to enable lecturers to support them better. And then we've got on the back-end side, people providing content like your publishers, for example, providing content for educational institutions, and we give them the tools basically to provide responsive content and all for that will actually fit the students. And then you've got on the other side the educators like your HODs and all that need to manage the lecturers. So we've got tools that help them really improve productivity and all. So that's really where we focus, making sure that each stakeholder are able to transact with each other and using our platform basically. We do that.
And it shows you the opportunities exist all throughout the value chain in improving efficiencies compared with the old industrial world model of, 25 kids in a square box classroom physically interacting or even in a lecture room to take it to the tertiary level. How have you seen COVID accelerate or change or impact your rollout strategy and plans? Just take me through the last 12 months and how COVID has impacted Student Hub.
Right. On the COVID side, COVID has been an accelerator when it comes to educational institutions adopting technology. Because when we look at what we're currently doing now with educational institutions, the value proposition is not really changed. It's the same that we brought to them 4 years ago. It's just that with COVID-19, we've seen an acceleration of in terms of adoption because there was a need for that. But on the student side, we did not really see much change because students were always keen to look at technology really to learn. But in educational institutions, we've seen a drastic change in behavior, and then they've really been at the forefront of actually reaching out for us to assist them with the infrastructure and all to be able to move online. So COVID-19 has been really that event that that everyone was actually waiting for, that wake-up call to say that if you're not you're not online really, and then you're not using technology to deliver quality education, you'll be left behind. And it was almost like a wake-up call for education institutions. We've seen more on the education institution side than on the student side.
As most parents will attest to, you very quickly had to adapt to how you conduct classes at home via Teams or Zoom, whatever platform you were on. And I think, Kerry, from a parent's perspective, you've had a look at the various offerings at a primary and high school level that are now out there in the South African market. How does the cost of virtual schooling actually compare to that of traditional in-person learning?
Thanks, Michael. I think what we're seeing already are some of the advantages that the sort of deflationary forces of technology are pushing that are now coming through an education cost. So, you know, a lot of the old traditional schools, I can't remember who it was that mentioned, I think Wesley earlier on your show, around sort of out with the old and in with the new. And what we're really seeing is sort of a blend of the old at the moment with new technology that's helping to push down these costs. So you're getting these sort of premium schools, what historically were seen as premium schools, that were charging sort of anything from 73,000 to 200,000 rand a year, depending on the grade, that are now able to offer their curriculum online to their learners at probably a 40% saving on average, you know, to what they were charging for the pure sort of old model, if you like. And of course, in a country where, you know, savings are really kind of seen at a premium, I mean, I guess in any emerging market economy, as Ashutosh mentioned earlier, you know, you need any saving in that regard is helpful, where people can save for their retirement or create other experiences or advantages for their kids. So it's probably a 40% saving in the traditional model, Michael. And then, of course, as you move to the lower income, sort of early middle income. I mean, if you look now at sort of the democratization of that technology into these poorer communities or traditionally poorer communities, you can get a very, very high level of education in a purely online offering for circa 3,500 to 25,000 rand per year, which obviously is a big saving on the numbers that we were speaking about earlier, if you look at sort of these purely old school, you know, traditional private schools. So, you know, depending on where you're at sort of in that spectrum, you know, certainly there's, you know, there's a significant saving to be had, which can be put to other uses.
And Kerry, it's hard to find a loser in a scenario that you paint, because what you're doing is you're democratizing access to good quality education on the one hand. And on the other hand, the private institutions and private schools with the brand names are going to have to work really hard to justify that premium. But again, that is a positive force working on those private institutions.
100%, Michael, and you see that everywhere. I mean, you see this is a global phenomenon, obviously, and what I've noticed is that, you know, you're now starting to get offered sort of access to sort of tertiary education sort of offerings, premium schools. I'm talking about Ivy League colleges, sort of INSEAD, Harvard, Yale, etc., and obviously, you know, those are just the brand names that everybody knows. But now all of a sudden you can get access to that kind of content from those kinds of schools, which really was reserved for a very privileged few globally historically. Almost anybody now with any modicum of means can get access to that kind of content. And I think that what you mentioned earlier around sort of artificial intelligence and big data, you know, sort of driving this is only a theme that's going to continue. And I mean, I think what we're really excited about is the fact that, you know, we've had such poor access to education. It's a sort of often quoted you know, sort of problem or challenge that South Africa faces. I think Ashutosh mentioned that, you know, in India as well. You know, what's really exciting is the ability to now start pushing some of this content as multiple technology sort of improvements converge, things like sort of access to power, you know, from solar or clean energy in areas where there weren't historically power. Access to data, you know, sort of the cost of data slowly comes down. You know, hopefully that's a trend that continues. And of course, the third element of that is content, you know, with all of this incredible content being produced and sort of being utilized sort of in video format, etc. I mean, you can imagine how, you know, how this could radically change the face of education in all elements of South African society.
And in terms of a growth path, Ashu, to come back to the Baidu example in India, what is the growth path from here? Because it does also seem to be a market that's highly fragmented at the moment. There are lots of startups all trying to solve their little piece of the education value chain puzzle. Is it a period of allowing those startups to go out there and thrive? And as an investor in this space, do you start building at scale and bringing all of these pieces together and consolidating them? Just take me through your thinking as you look to build Baidu out in India. And I'm sure you've got plans to take Baidu internationally as well.
Sure, absolutely. And by the way, Baidu is already going international as we speak. But sticking to India for the moment, your audience will be very interested to know, Michael, that Baidu is the largest edtech company in India. but at this time still has only 2 million paid subscribers out of the 215 million. So the one vector for the company to grow is grow this subscriber base. Now, we totally understand that whatever Baiju charges today per year may be affordable for the top 15, 20 million students in India. And therefore, the product, the pricing plan will need to change as Baiju goes or plans to go beyond the top 20 million. One of the things, for example, that we are doing is to offer EMIs or installment-based payment for your sort of annual subscription fee or loans in some cases to pay for your annual subscription fee. So one vector is to go deep in the subscriber base. The other vector that we're trying to pursue at this time is add adjacencies. So currently the company is offering asynchronous online learning, asynchronous in the sense that you can, whenever you have time, you open the tab and can use the platform. But then we are also adding live one-to-many courses. It's at a slight bit of a premium to your sort of asynchronous learning, but still, if you can afford it, it's a very, very interesting proposition. We're also adding live one-to-one doubt clearing sessions. And then on top of that, we're also adding non-curriculum courses, so like coding or ancient Indian math and stuff like that. So I think as Baiju, we believe that there is these two vectors on which we have to work on for the company to grow from here.
But it shows you at 2 million out of 250 million, the runway for growth is vast. Wesley, what is Snapplify focused on at the moment? I know last year you acquired Oni Media and Teacher, which is Africa's largest independent online teacher community. You've raised funds from a very well-known venture capital firm in Knife Capital. You've got some good seed backers in Michael Jordan. What's your growth path from here?
So I think the stage we're at, I think we've reached the point that we know what our value proposition is. We know how to take it to market, and it's really focused on expansion. Definitely a focus on Africa as the core opportunity for expansion. But you know, with COVID, we acquired new schools really all over the world. So we've also broadened out now to focus on specifically online schools, regardless of where they are based. You know, we're servicing online schools that are, you know, based in the Middle East or Malaysia or South America just as effectively as we are those in, you know, South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria. So that's a great opportunity for us. And then we're also looking at growth opportunities that are more strategic and, you know, less organic. So we'll continue to do acquisitions. I think this is really important in the African market, I think, which is maybe slightly different to perhaps what we see in India. You know, you used the word already, fragmentation. I think that's a big challenge for us to try and get scale. So, you know, a great way to address that is to find companies that are perhaps in other countries that have got great teams, local presence, and with an injection of some of our capital and our technology can unlock more immediate value. So there's really the organic growth that we see in new markets, and then those strategic acquisitions are really the core two strategies for us going forward.
Hertzie, we've got a minute and a bit to go. What's your growth path from here?
Right. I mean, at the moment, we really are focusing on solving the pain points that online education has created for undergraduate students. We understand that online education is being really functional at this point, which is basically giving you content and taking you through it. But then it is, in the process, created a lot of pain points for the traditional undergraduate students that really choose the campus experience compared to the online experience. And at the moment, we're really focusing on solving those pain points to get to a bigger market share in the space and become the first choice. When students have to move into undergraduate education, they first look at our online value proposition versus the campus one, which is a direct competitor to online when you look at it. So solving those pain points is really the focus at the moment in order to grow. And when we look at the vocational space, the target is to grow to 2.5 million people at any given time, being online education in South Africa. And then right now, doing vocational courses in South Africa, and we're only sitting about 700,000 people, students currently in the vocational space across the country, which is quite small compared to the 2.5 million that's a target by 2030.
Yeah.
And we believe that higher education is, of course, the solution to addressing the scale issue.
Especially at a time, and Kerry, just as a concluding thought, when we see the student protests seemingly a feature in the South African marketplace at a tertiary level, year in, year out, it's about access, it's about bringing costs down. All the forces seem to be heading in the right direction. Just as a concluding thought, are your clients now increasingly asking you about online schooling as an option for their children? Or is it still potentially seen as something that's really for a low emerging LSM segment?
No, Michael, it's definitely, I think it's a question that's on everyone's minds at the moment. And I think where people are defensive at the moment, and I think where people can save money and they're starting to realize that they can not only save money, but they can actually provide their kids with a better access to more quality global education and have optionality. As you mentioned earlier, you know, they can still travel, you know, they can do other things, you know, they can have optionality around sort of where they live. You know, you're no longer constrained now by sort of the school on your neighborhood corner. You can actually pick and choose, and optionality is a wonderful thing in life. We've just got to democratize it further and further. But I'm hopeful that this trend will continue to sort of increase that, you know, as I said, which is very exciting for South Africa.
Very exciting indeed. Kerry Finn, CEO of Alpha Wealth, who is joined around the table by Ashu Sharma, head of Process Ventures in India, Wesley Lynch, CEO and founder of Snaplify, and our other founder, Hirti Kabeya, who's the founder and CEO of the Student Hub, but talking about EdTech. And surely the democratization of education is the big winner out of COVID-19. It'll be very interesting to see how the theme and the trend plays out from here.